has been primarily in the area of the black athletes, which received a great deal of publicity in Life magazine and in Sports Illustrated. It's a little bit difficult to follow Leo in a subject of poverty and hunger, and in a sense, this perhaps is not nearly as important as his subject.
But I kind of, in a way, not fully agree with that, because race, you're on the subject of racism, is probably one of the great hazards for civilization.
I think you're right. I think in its most violent end result, it not only can destroy our country, it can destroy our Christianity. They say there are 20 million black people in the United States. I guess that figure is basically correct. There were far fewer people than that in the Confederacy, and they came very close to destroying the Union. For a long time in sports, and this is a kind of a panacea that has been built up by the press, by radio, by television, you've heard of the equality on the playing field, where a person is judged not by his color or his religion or his national origin, but by how well he performs. And it sounds wonderful. It has never been true, and it is not true today. I wish to God it were. Willie Mays of the San Francisco Giants makes a heck of a lot more money than I do. Probably around $150,000 a year. And yet he cannot live where he wants in the city of San Francisco. He could not buy the home he wished to buy in San Francisco. He could not buy any one of his first three choices in the city of San Francisco, even though he's willing to pay cash. And even though he is an outstanding gentleman, a very fine gentleman. The University of Washington was singled out by a man by the name of Professor Harry Edwards of San Jose State University. Professor Edwards is a prime mover in black power in the area of athletics. It is Professor Edwards' idea, it was his idea, it is his goal, for a boycott of the Olympics by black athletes, boycotting the United States Olympic team. He is backed in this by Stokely Carmichael, Rat Brown, and to a much lesser degree by other black civil rights leaders. His effort, and this is really a many-fold thing. So try not to draw any conclusions before I get done, and I will be very brief. The initial effort was based on the Pacific Coast Conference, which is the AAWU, the Association of Athletic Western University, Athletic Association of Western University. It was a three-pronged plan. The destruction of intercollegiate athletics at the University of California, Berkeley. Total destruction of intercollegiate athletics. The resignation in mass of the national championship UCLA basketball team. And the forced resignation of Jim Owens, the athletic director of the University of Washington. These were the first three initial goals of this move. At the University of California, they have been basically successful. Pete Newell, the athletic director, was forced to resign. Their basketball coach was forced to resign. I could give you a personal insight on that, but that's probably not worth anything. I don't think it was any great loss. At the University of Washington, now at the University of California, where Professor Edwards had a direct hand and a direct control, and this is very important. There were 40-some black athletes. They called a press conference on a Tuesday, at which time they laid out before the press all of their individual grievances, the things that had been done wrong, the individual cases of prejudice, of discrimination, naming names, places, dates, demanding the resignation of various coaches. On Wednesday morning, they went to the chancellor and said, "We have a problem." And the chancellor said, "Yes, I read about it this morning, too." And from that point on, progress was very nearly impossible because it had been placed into the newspapers. And it got to the point where the newspapers were calling a young man by the name of Presley, who was the center on their basketball team, asking him who he was going to hire as the new basketball coach at the University of California. And this scared this young man to death. He never wanted this. And he has said this. He has said it to me. He said it to various black athletes at the University of Washington. At the University of California at Los Angeles, one athlete did resign, Edgar Lee. The rest did not. And no one is really quite sure what happened. And so the whole drive centered on the University of Washington. Harry Edwards paid a visit to campus, and 2 days later, the 14 black athletes at the University of Washington paid a visit to the president of the university, Dr. Odegaard, at which time they laid down four claims. One, they demanded the resignation of the trainer, calling him a racist. Secondly, they demanded the immediate hiring of a black coach or administrator within the athletic department. Third, they demanded a complete review of the athletic department to determine whether or not there was any further racism within the department. And their fourth was the creation of a committee of black athletes, which would operate in a variety of ways. And at this point, we get to the crux of what could ultimately lead to a violent destruction, or at least a violent confrontation of black power against white power, if you will, in this country. Because this fourth area, this fourth thing, this committee, was immediately taken by the press and totally distorted. It was taken by Life magazine and misquoted. It was taken by Sports Illustrated and misquoted. It was taken by the two Seattle newspapers and misquoted. And misquoted in three successive days after three successive efforts by the athletes themselves to clarify. Now, the committee was to operate in this manner. If an athlete was demoted on a team or reprimanded and went to a coach and said why and got no answer, no answer at all, then the committee would go to the athletic director, head football coach, Owens is in a dual capacity, and find out why. It would never operate under any other circumstance. And yet Life magazine, Sports Illustrated, the Seattle Times, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, as well as several radio and TV stations, reported it as the setting up of a committee that would tell the football coach how to run the team to the point of calling the plays in the huddle and saying who would play and who would not play. Now, obviously, this was a situation, I'm sure all of you are familiar with the university, that an organization within a university simply could not live with, because there would be no administration. And it immediately put the black athletes in a position which was totally untenable, And so I did one thing that I'm not particularly proud of doing, frankly. But I frankly don't see how anyone could do anything else. I went to these young men, realizing that at least three of them were militant separatists, which I totally disagree with, and I told them so. And I said, look, three of your claims I don't know a great deal about. One of your claims I know is true, because I had seen it happen. I had seen it happen myself, and I had stood there. I had stood there when a Negro athlete was sent into the training room for a whirlpool bath by a white coach and was greeted by the trainer with the words, "What do you want here, nigger?" And this guy was an All-American end. And I stood there, and I didn't say anything. And I figured that if these 14 young men were willing to put their futures, their education on the line, then the least I could do is put my job on the line. And I discussed it with my wife, and we decided that there are some things that are more valuable than living in suburbia. And this is one of them. I never promised to present only their side. The only thing I promised them was that when they wanted something said, when they wanted their statement read the way it was written, that's what I would do. And for 8 weeks, and please, don't misunderstand, I don't say this to my credit. For 8 weeks, our station was the only station, to my knowledge, in the United States, that accurately quoted these young men. Now, I'm not suggesting that the situation at the University of Washington can be compared to what it might be, say, at Niagara, or at St. Bonaventure, or Harvard, or Columbia, or Georgia Tech, or anywhere else. I am saying that the situation in the press, as it manifested itself in Seattle, is the very same thing that's being manifested throughout the United States. And there is no question about it, because it didn't just happen in Seattle. It wasn't just Seattle radio, or TV, or newspapers. It was Life magazine. It was Sports Illustrated. It was the New York Times. And this scares me. It scares me to death. Now, the upshot of what happened at the University of Washington was the creation of a committee which conducted a full and open investigation. Anyone and everyone who wanted to appear before that committee was invited to do so. That included alumni, it included the black athletes, the coaches, anyone and everyone. The report was issued, it was not published. A statement was read by Owens, in which really there was very little concrete progress made in that statement. In other words, nothing was really done then. What the statement did do was set up machinery, set up the possibility of creating certain provisions that if it didn't make prejudice impossible within an athletic department at the University of Washington, it certainly would make it exceedingly difficult to manifest itself. The night of that statement, these young men met again, and they asked me to attend their meeting. And when I walked into the room, they had just cast a ballot 13-1 against accepting the statement. Now, if they didn't accept the statement, what it amounted to was a boycott of intercollegiate athletics the next day in a track meet against the University of Oregon, which sounds like nothing, except that if they boycotted the next day, their grant and aid would have been revoked the following day, and they would have been out of school, and they would have lost their college education. So they had a lot right. They had a great deal right. And we talked for 2 hours. And the upshot, I think, of the whole thing was that eventually they realized that when they started this, their effort, no matter what the press might say, and I have some classic examples of how they distorted, was not for revenge. Harry Edwards, by the way, got so angry at the University of Washington black athletes that he completely revoked and reneged on several promises that he had made to them.
Who's Harry Edwards?
Harry Edwards is Harry Edwards is associate professor at San Jose State University.
Oh, yeah.
So is the leader in this black boycott. The upshot was that they did accept the statement with the understanding that Owens would have to implement what he said he was going to do, and that is hire a black coach. Maintain the highest standards of human relations within the training department of the athletic department. Highest standards of human relations. As I said to these young men, if the trainer's going to put his foot through that thin ice, let him put it through, don't you push it. But if he puts it through, he goes. And I, for one, will see to it that he does go, because I'll put it on the air. And I'll quote him. If he says nigger again, I'll quote him. Well, the statement stayed this way for about 2 months of this kind of never, never, what's going to happen type thing. Last week, the University of Washington hired a young man by the name of Carver Gayton, who was the number one choice for a black coach of every major school in the United States. And what they had to do to meet this guy's salary is unbelievable. Owens was exceedingly happy to get it. The university was exceedingly happy to get him, to the point where they have also made him an assistant to the vice president of the university, and now Owens is afraid that he's going to lose him to the hill. The thing that kind of sustained me throughout this thing was that I knew that Jim Owens was a, well, let's face it, he's a very opinionated person. He's the type of coach who hates to lose. He's the type of coach who believes that if he practices for 6 days and on the seventh day loses the game, he is much like an attorney who has worked for 5 weeks in a courtroom and lost a case, or a doctor who has spent 14 hours in an operating room and not cured his patient. It's his job. And I can't blame him for that. But he is also a Christian, and he is a Christian in a very strong way. And then by a strong way, I mean he has no qualms about standing up before 5,000 people and reading from the Bible and saying, I am a Christian, Christ is my Savior. And this is the one thing that kept me going, believing that if this man could find out what was going on in his own school, in his own department, he would change it. Now, one of the things this report that was not published stated was that in no school is it possible for one man to be athletic director and head football coach. And I think it's right. I think it is true that Jim Owens didn't know what was going on in his school. I think he does know what was going on now, and I don't think it will ever happen again. The formula that was used at the University of Washington, and once again, I think this is a failure in our mass communication media, because this part of it you have not heard. No part of the United States has heard this. You've read perhaps the article in Life. Many of you perhaps have read what Sports Illustrated had to say, or the Times, New York Times. But no one has written an article that 56 major universities have used the University of Washington formula to solve the problems of their black athletes in their athletic departments before it came to a head, before it was forced to the issue of a boycott. The creation of a student committee was incorporated into a campus-wide, all-group student committee with direct access to the athletic director, in which the black athletes are represented. And it was at this point that Harry Edwards dropped out. Because you see, if the university, and I think this applies to society, if the university could find a solution for their black athlete problem that was a solution for the entire university of 30,000 students, of which only 200 are black, if they could find a solution that involved all 30,000, then a Harry Edwards, a black power, a separatist, a militant, a burn baby burn, he has no basis for his next step, because his basis is no longer that 200, it's 30,000. And the 30,000 don't agree with him. And the 30,000 will never agree with him unless they once again push the 200 out. And there's always that need. To give you some idea of what you're reading in your newspapers, let me give you one example, just one example of what happened. There was a great fear among these young men that this whole investigation would die in committee, that it would never come out, something like our Congress, something like gun control laws, and get tabled year after year. And so they went to the chairman of the committee, who happened to be the head of the civil engineering department, and told him that if there was not an indication of progress in the investigation, that 10 days later they would boycott. 10 days later. I think it's kind of interesting to note that the head of the civil engineering department never called the athletic director and informed him that his black athletes were threatening to boycott intercollegiate athletics at the same school they were both working for. There was no communication. They called me that night at 10:30, and I went on the air at 11. And I wrote a story and called them back, read it to them, and they said, that is an accurate quote. That is, if there is not an indication of progress, we will boycott. And I put it on the air at 20 after 11. At 11:35, the Associated Press and the United Press International wires carried a story saying that unless there was a complete solution to the problems of black athletes at the University of Washington, they would boycott intercollegiate athletics. What you do? I blew my staff.
What was the result?
And I did it on the air. The result was rather interesting. One newspaper, much to their credit, I think, the Post and Telegraph, finally realized what was going on. And by the end of it, they were taking great pains to make sure that what they were printing was correct. The other newspaper, I think much to their discredit, went on to the most fabulous lengths I have ever seen in my life. Now, using the same example I have just given you, the next day after this announcement of if progress isn't made, there will be a boycott, the next day they met with the committee. And at that time, the committee showed that progress was being made. And at 6 o'clock the next night, the black athletes withdrew their threat of a boycott. They withdrew it. It was done. 48 hours later, the Seattle Times ran a front page column, more or less editorial column, but written by the sports editor, based on the statement that unless there was a full settlement by Friday, the black athletes would boycott intercollegiate athletics. 48 hours after the whole thing was over. And the important thing is that people read it and they believe it. How many times have you heard it? How do you know that's true? I read it in the paper. Something like, I don't know. To me, the end result at the University of Washington, in this case, to me was a very beneficial, it was a tremendous thing. It was a great result for me to see these young men stand up on their hind legs as men, to see a lot of them grow up, to see a lot of them, one young man from Watts, pretty good football team, go from being a real rock and sock and militant to someone who now can sit down and discuss and reason without compromising himself, but still try to find, as he terms it, I've changed from demands to solutions. That's a big step. That's a big step, I think. So at the University of Washington, I think a great, wonderful thing has happened. But all of you people who are from the Northwest know that we are still, John Kennedy called it the new frontier. And I guess we're the last frontier. These mountains kind of isolated somewhat. We are a large metropolitan area that's still very colloquial, small. And I sometimes wonder if what we do in Seattle has any bearing at all on what happens in Los Angeles or Chicago and New York. And I don't know if it will have any bearing on what happens in Chicago or New York. But I know that this very same problem that almost blew the lid off in Seattle is going to blow the lid off. And it's going to blow it off in the next 2 months. The Black Power has many, many manifestations, and I'm not going to take any time to go into those because there's too many. But the one that you will read about, the one you'll hear about, and the one you will talk about is the Olympics. And what will the black athletes do? Well, according to the information I have, and it's from a pretty good source, there was a meeting of black athletes at Berkeley, at which time, by the way, the representative from the University of Washington got up and explained what had happened on his campus, and over 400 black athletes booed Stokely Carmichael and Harry Edwards out of that room and passed a resolution unanimously which stated, and this is a direct quote, "We need a Stokely Carmichael like we need a hole in the head." They also passed a resolution to boycott the Olympics. Now, what form this boycott will take is questionable. I don't know. What the latest information I have is that they will participate in the Olympics. They will not march in the opening parade behind the American flag. They will not mount the honor steps to receive their medals and stand at attention during the national anthem. Now why? Why are they doing this? Well, for a very simple reason. They feel that it's paramount to place before world opinion, not just the United States opinion, but world opinion, the fact that, well, progress is being made in the United States, and there is much dialogue, and there is much talk, there is still much much prejudice. There is much, much discrimination. There is much, much exploitation. And much of that exploitation is taking place in what you and I are reading every day. We have always accused the communists of brainwashing. I sometimes think they've got their rudimentary lessons from us.
What do you think this is symptomatic of, this distortion of the truth?
I think it's symptomatic of what used to be called about 10 years ago, Hearstism. The ability to sell a newspaper for 10 cents on the corner. My wife doesn't agree with me on this, but the fact still remains that the New York Times, for all intents and purposes, before the Christian Science model from the standpoint of objectivity, the greatest newspapers in the world. I perhaps the London.
Sir, how do you respond to the Sports Illustrated distributed 5 days ago? From that article, I gather that the black athletes at the University of Washington are not at all satisfied with the present football coach. And from the general trend of this article, it would seem that the problem is not at all solved.
Well, the article that was circulated 5 days ago, I spent about 8 days with that reporter. And the only time that man was in Seattle and talked with the athletes was during the first week of this entire affair. His two sources, his two prime sources of information are one, Creed Hubbard, who has since quit the football team and was one of the militants, and Harvey Blanch, who was also a militant. And Harvey has changed his tune considerably. The third militant was Otis Washington. And he is the young man who is now talking solutions rather than demands. My point is this, that Sports Illustrated has made the statement that they are not satisfied with the football coach. They are not at all satisfied with the statement that was made. And it's a real rip-snorting article. And it will sell a lot of magazines. But 3 days after that magazine came out, Carver Gayton was hired as the first full-time black coach at the University of Washington. The number one black coach in the United States. Perhaps one of the number one black people, black, white, yellow, any kind of people. That's an outstanding human being.
Do the athletes complain? Do they still remain the same about their football coach, even though there has been some progress made? The Sports Illustrated, Jack Olson, is that the gentleman's name?
Yes.
He seemed to stress the fact that the Husky way was actually the white way. This was their slogan, and this is what was instigated by this coach.
Well, let me put you this way. I would say that probably for the Owens, I think, has been there now for 11 years, and I would say for the first 7 years, he's dead right. I would say for the last 4 years, he's probably dead wrong. He's dead wrong from the standpoint of, here's a man who came up from Oklahoma, who after 3 weeks before this investigating committee, and I got this from one of the black athletes who was sitting there. He said it was just like somebody pulled a light bulb over his head. And he said he stood up from the table and he said, I was prejudiced. He said, I just suddenly realized that I was a prejudiced person. I didn't like black people. And he said, I didn't realize it until right now. And I think this happens to a great, great number of people. A great number. The Husky way of being a white way, yes, probably for the last 7 years. I don't think that it's true anymore. I don't think it's true anymore simply, if for no other reason, on the basis of the the 20 days of spring practice that they had this past spring, when both black and white athletes said that for the first time in their lives, they felt that when they walked into the dressing room after practice and they said something to one another, they were actually saying what they felt. Can you imagine that? For the first time in their lives, a black person was able to look at a white person and actually say what he felt. Now, I think that's a big step. I think the perpetuation of, if that's a word, of this story is a beaut. And I think it's a great vehicle for selling a continuing, kind of like a serial type thing, where it can be used as a core and we can build around it. Something will happen at Niagara where they have an outstanding basketball player. He's the only Negro in the school. And they'll compare it to Washington. But Washington will always be the core, and they can keep this thing going and keep the pot churning all the time. But truth has nothing to do with it. And this is the great danger. You see, the danger is not in exposing the problem. That's vital. It's absolutely vital that we expose the problem. It's vital that we get involved. That we stick our necks out. This is my opinion. That every time you run into prejudice, you call it. You call it right now. It doesn't go any further. When a person makes a bigoted statement, you say bigot. When someone exploits someone, you say exploited. And you stop it right then. But it's just as wrong. It's just as wrong to not tell the story of how any progress is made. Because if the only thing that the press is going to report is prejudice, exploitation, discrimination, trouble, then what's your result? How long can you boil the stew without burning it? Eventually, this thing will blow up. And it will blow up in violence. You mark my words. These people will not be pushed. They've had it. They've had it up to their necks. I got too involved, I got too close, and thank God they thought enough of me, or at least they thought I was enough involved that I didn't dare do anything else than to tell the truth and not betray their confidence. And I do know how they feel. They feel they're human beings. And feel their children of God too. So do I.
You were suggesting a distortion of the is primarily commercial. I mean, but I think these are obvious results of this kind of myopia that sees you know, black things in certain ways. And we saw a beautiful example of it that Cincinnati right before I came, a friend of ours was telling the story. He's a college professor, and they have a very close friend who's a Negro. And this Negro is a musician, and he's a very small man and very delicate feature, the kind of guy who would sort of blow away in the wind. And he came to visit them, and they just moved into a new apartment, and he didn't quite know where they lived, so he knocked on the wrong door. And this guy answered the door, white guy answered the door, and sort of reacted to him. He was knocking on my door. So this guy kind of stumbled away and finally found the right place. And later on, this man came over to the man who was being visited and said, did you know that a high-paid black man was looking for you? Oh, so that's just a beautiful thing. Just the way you say things.
Last year when all the cities in the east, Detroit, were having
next time he told us, he's got a knife in it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That, and this is a good example of what you just said. When Detroit was burning, and they really had tremendous, terrible problems. There was a story that ran on the wire that made headlines in the New York papers and across the country. I thought Chicago too. That race violence hits the out. Now I happen to know what that race violence was because the violence involved happened to one of the salesmen who worked for our station. Three colored boys walked across some of these shrubberies, which was along the public sidewalk. He ran out the door and they ran away. And that was it. A newspaper in Yakima printed a story that at the time of the Gold Cup race in Seattle, the unlimited hydroplane race, a group of Negroes armed with bazookas, bombs, guns, napalm, the whole works, were stopped on the floating bridge by state police and turned back, and it stopped the burning of the city of Seattle. This was reported in the front page of the Yakima Eagle. Well, the state police didn't even have any cars on the floating bridge that day. There was no sign of violence. There were 500,000 people by some estimates. I think the lowest estimate I heard was 200,000 along the shores of Lake Washington that day. I would say at least a fourth of them were black. And there were no incidents of any kind. And yet this story got circulated to the east part of the United States too. But Seattle was saved by the quick action of the state police. Now this story, but not just to blame Eastern newspapers, to give you some idea of how this myopia gets started. These three kids who ran across the shrubbery, as God is my witness, called out the National Guard of the state of Washington 2 days later by order of the governor. This example of violence caused the mobilization of the National Guard to stand by in case of further violence. That was the order signed by the governor.
What's being done to correct, thus far I've heard you saying that a lot of this perhaps maybe our own prejudice is caused by a misrepresentation and perhaps even a deliberate distortion of the truth on the part of the newspapers. What is being done to, let's say, channel and to wrap the knuckles of the newspaper reporters and editors and owners and publishers to let's come up with the truth, so that we as a public can be informed accurately?
Well, some stations, some newspapers are.
Well, they were called out about 2 weeks ago in the press convention.
The newspapers, the radio and television, the Washington Association of Broadcasters were leveled pretty badly for their reporting on this issue.
What about the international wire services?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I have control over one part of one television station. That's all. One. Most of you have no control over any part of any television, radio, or newspaper. But I would say, rather than what are they doing about it, I would say, what are you doing about it? I would say, first of all, just how much credence are you putting in what you read? How much are you searching a story for facts? How many headlines are you reading and how many stories are you reading? How carefully do you look through a news story to see whether or not it's reporting of news facts or if it is in fact an editorial? As most news stories are, of course.
I wonder if we could
legal day off immediately, part of that, the art room over, and get back to the question of Black Power. You were very happy, apparently, that some of these militants stopped being militants, like I said, threatened. And did you, were very pleased that Harry Edwards, is that his name? Harry Edwards disowned these guys, and of these black athletes that we need to go through Carmichael, like a bull in the head. I can't blame any black athlete who hangs on to his scholarship. I mean, that's being sensible, and I wouldn't have the courage to do any better. But I wonder if they're not wrong, Gilson Carmichael and Harry Edwards aren't right.
I would say that this is a case, again, of there's no way of saying that the black athletes were totally right. In the first place, let me make it very, very clear that the black athletes at Washington didn't sell out in any of their demands. They got everything they asked, bar none.
Then why was Harry Edwards so angry?
Harry Edwards was so angry because it was his intent and purpose to fire Jim Owens.
Why did he want to do that?
He wanted to fire Jim Owens simply to dramatize the problem of racial discrimination and prejudice in the United States, and in particular in the area of athletics. And this was also the case for his purpose in trying to get the mass resignation of the UCLA basketball team, and also the total disruption of intercollegiate athletics in Berkeley. Now, by the same token, I don't wish to give the impression that this person sitting here disagrees with Harry Edwards or Sophie Carmichael and many of the things they said, because I don't. What has Black Power said, basically? If you will sit down and read what Sophie Carmichael has said instead of what someone has said about Sophie Carmichael. Mm-hmm. Sophie Carmichael has said that it's time that the black man has some pride in himself. And I think that's something that each one of us, it becomes pretty necessary to have some, at least, if not pride, at least some self-respect. And this was, and still is, Sophie Carmichael's basic definition of black power.
Well, he also said that, and I was black power people too. One of the things that black people have to be aware of when they get into positions of power, as black athletes are in black athletes in the Olympics, they really got it because they are in that position at this time in prison, is that when you are in a position, you must be aware of white solutions. Because whenever you are the minority, and you are being given something by the majority, no matter what goodwill, it can always be removed.
This is
when
true.
When the goodwill starts to falter a little bit, that's in the trouble. We call them a lot of things, a lot of goodwill, and good hearts and so forth. And then it gets taken away, and the person remains subjugated. He's being given, and it's being taken. And Black Power says, no. You only enter into a coalition when you've got something to gain, and so does the white man. And operate in the situation, and you're not getting something, he's not giving you something to take away.
I think this is one of the things that, if it didn't upset Harry Edwards, it frustrated him, because the solutions that were reached at the university were, as you say, a solution of not the black athletes being given something. They weren't given anything, really. It was a solution for both sides, where the university, day by day, is realizing that they have gained far more by what has happened, perhaps, than even the black athletes. The solution of the black athletes has led to a drive by the university, financed by the university, to bring more black students into the University of Washington. Perhaps as many as 5,000, hopefully, that who perhaps cannot meet the entrance requirements because of superior education opportunities in secondary grades. But those requirements will be waived with the understanding that they meet the requirements as freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and those requirements will not be waived. But the first step was the solution with the black athletes, and it was a solution whereby both parties came to a meaningful solution. It was not a giving in of one side or another. And I agree with Harry Edwards wholeheartedly in this. And I agree with Harry Edwards when he says that when a black person is in a position of authority or public image, that it is his job to dramatize, to bring to the attention of as many people as possible the problems that we face in this country. And hopefully to make people become involved. One of the questions that was raised before many of you arrived was, what do we do when, now that we have all moved to suburbia, how does suburbia get back in to the ghetto, if you wish to use that term? All right, many of us live in suburbia, but there are no walls around suburbia that I know of. There are highways that lead into the ghetto, and they are two-way roads. And if we live in suburbia, it doesn't mean we have to spend all our time in suburbia. And it doesn't mean that those people have to spend all their time in the ghetto. And it doesn't mean that we cannot and should not and must not become involved to make sure that those people can't get out of those ghettos. Not as a gift, not... And I think this is what Harry Edwards is saying, basically, is that the Negro is sick and tired of getting the handout. He doesn't, there's a certain portion who still want the welfare check, but by and large, they don't want the handout anymore. They want the opportunity. They want the equality. They want the chance to earn a living. The man who's head of his family wants to be able to come home at night with a paycheck, so that when his kids sit down at the table, they know that their dad earned that meal. It wasn't given to him by Orville Freeman, and it isn't powdered milk.
That's the reason they looted in Detroit and Chicago.
No, they looted in Chicago and Detroit for the same reason that the white people looted in Chicago and Detroit. The opportunity is different. You give a lawless element, a lawless situation anywhere in this world, and you will have looting and rioting. You will have it in Shanghai, you'll have it in Tokyo, you'll have it in Buenos Aires, and you'll have it in Chicago, Detroit.
There were two Negro youth in the, I mean, there are two Negro youth in the that I don't know of in Los Angeles, but when I heard Rita Johnson several newscast kind of not saying terribly much about the UCLA, especially the UCLA thing, because he was a UCLA graduate. But suddenly he is gone from NBC. Is this a new thing that's connected to UCLA?
My understanding of Raper's association with NBC, it was a strictly a more or less a one-way deal where Raper was available for as much time as he could put into it, and as I think everyone is aware, he became very involved with the campaign of Senator Robert Kennedy, and
it seems to me that he didn't say too much.
Well, there wasn't much to say about UCLA, frankly, because when Lacey quit, nothing else happened. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the case at all. I think the point is made up there. You don't blame anyone for trying to hold on to their scholarship, and I think that's what happened. At the University of Washington, I don't think there's any question that these kids laid their scholarship very squarely on the line.
What are these fellows like? Do you think that they're the only?
They think that the owners is an Uncle Tom. I think he's an Uncle Tom for the pure and simple reason that Jesse Owens, as much as I respect the man as an athlete, he's a great athlete, I've lived in Illinois, and I know that he's done a tremendous amount for the youth program in the state of Illinois. But Jesse Owens, in his public pronouncement, by and large, refuses to recognize the fact that there's prejudice in the United States, and abjectly refuses to recognize the fact that there is prejudice and racism and discrimination in athletics. And he's dead wrong. That simply isn't so. If there is.
Why did it pop and boil over 30, 40 years ago?
It did, by the way. I'm unaware that there was race riots in the 1920s. Virtually the same point in the
There was a few in 1940, what, one or two in Harlem?
You should read the book from Race Riot to Sin, that phrase is from 1920 to 1960.
Yes.
And one in Detroit in 38 and 9.
Or did they have the leadership? Probably.
Well, they didn't have the leadership. They didn't have, yeah.
I'd like to put a, maybe a little jarring note here. I agree with every effort that's being made to reduce prejudice. I think it's a national sickness that ought to be cut out and cured, if possible. But when you talk about these black athletes in the Olympics refusing to march behind the flag, refusing to partake in the national anthem, I wonder, is there any major country in the world where the black man has the opportunity he has here, imperfect as it may be?
None. But that doesn't make it right.
No, but does it mean that you have to repudiate your country in front of the world?
I think you have to repudiate the third verse of the national anthem.
Would you quote, please?
Well, it has something to do with equality, we are one nation under God, that we are equal, that we are free, and that we are a land of opportunity. And I don't think we are for many, many of our people. Frankly, no one is more emotional or more schmaltzy when it comes to patriotism than yours truly. I have to agree, I think, with John Glenn. I get a lump in my throat, too, when the flag goes by. Because I'm proud of that flag. But I am proud enough of that flag to make every effort to make it what it should be and what it is not. And recognize that it is not what it should be. You see, here's the point that suddenly hit me when I was working with these young men and found myself alone working with these young men. That I was whitey. I'm white. I'm humble. Me. Because there are 170 million of me. We made this system. We are this system. We cast the votes. We made the system. And because there are 170 million of us and 20 million of them, we are the people who can change, and we are the only people who can change. And by our apathy, we are guilty. By our non-involvement, we are guilty.
Perhaps addressed to your question, you know, as far as national fervor, patriotism, you know, we stand behind Patrick Henry's "Give me liberty or give me death." And I think right now the Negro is saying, my mom and my dad and my grandfather took this, but I'm not. Give me liberty or give me death. You know, and I think we kind of have to put him in the position of Patrick Henry and our forefathers who founded this nation, you know. They're breaking away from England And everybody rallied, would rally, all white would rally behind Patrick Henry. But it kind of hurts because the knife kind of sticks into us. Regardless of who we are, we have prejudices. And if our vested interests are going to be at stake, and if we're going to get shortchanged, even if we're not at fault, maybe somebody else is, we're going to smart. It's going to smart. Hurt.
Yeah, but this is their country, too.
Yes, it's their country. Is it? What is their country? That's the point. Their country is Harlem. Their country is the south side of Chicago. Their country is the central district of Seattle. My country's Newport Hills and Belleville. Some of you come from Wenatchee. Or I gave a speech up in Cedro Woolley, which is up toward the Canadian border. And I looked out on a group of totally white faces of young people who played in a conference that had never had a Negro athlete in it. And they wanted to hear about the black athlete situation at the University of Washington.
If they boycott the Olympics, what can be done, as far as you can see, to prevent the true reason why they're boycotting? You're referring here to the third verse of the national anthem. The first thing people are going to think is just, you know, what crummy characters, they don't appreciate what they've got.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first and only thing that can be done is just to be honest. And to say that who is going to be honest?
Yeah.
I hope we are. I was encouraged when one person who happened to be a person of authority in the Washington Association of Broadcasters stood up and blistered these stations and newspapers in Seattle for the way they handled it. And I was really blistered. Can I interject a question here? This is backtracking. You said, we who live in suburbia, you know, there are no walls here, and that highways go into the ghettos, and these are two ways. And I've got a brother working in Northside Minneapolis, and he is living in Northside Minneapolis with a Negro, specifically because the Negro will not respond to Whitey, who lives out in suburbia and commutes, and then for an 8-hour day helps him out, and then retreats to his cloister.
I think it has to go beyond 8 hours. I think it has to become 24 hours. I think what white America, at least white Christian America, must realize is that these people are our brothers, but we cannot expect them to think of themselves as their being our brothers.
The Northside Negroes may not be responding to your brother, but I happen to know that the Northside Negroes that I spent a week with at Holden Village are responding to commuters.
I think that very definitely that there's progress being made. And I don't want to divide 8 hours of effort, but I think it has to be a total commitment on the part of everyone. I think it has to be the statement on the lips of every person of not, gee, this is terrible. But as Joey Bishop said one night, what can I do? What can I do tomorrow morning?
Don't you think that the vote should be shifting from the white man going into the ghetto and commitment, the white man in suburbia? That's where the problem is. It's not a black problem, it's a white problem.
Indeed, it
white
is.
Racism. And the whole syndrome of the white man going into the ghetto to try and clean up the joint is no longer holding, and the black man is about it telling us that it is no good for him. And so the white man's place is not to go into the black community. The black man, first of all, will come. the white man's responsibility is in the white community, in white communities, to deal with the problem of racism there. And where we get hung up is by studying the black problem, studying the black man, what, you know, where all his hang-ups are and all this is, and completely then ignoring the real issue of our own problem, you know?
This idea of let's go in and clean up the ghetto and make it a nice place to live,
yeah,
and keep them in the ghetto. This is something like Hitler did, you know? You know, call it anything you want, but keep them in that ghetto.
And the biggest joke nowadays is that black man says, we want to stay in the ghetto, but we want it our ghetto. We don't want to go into the city. You know, that's your day. You can have it.
Well, for the black man who wants to stay in the ghetto, that should be his right. But for the black man who wants to come out of the ghetto, that should be his right. If I make $500,000 a year, never.
This discussion always sort of ignores the black middle class and the whole class tension within the black
community
and so on. And of course, that's the area where white people can integrate. It's pretty hard for middle class people to live in the downtown slums. If you can move into a black middle class area and sort of begin reversing the process of urban flight by building.
And this is where the
effort, back into the city.
This is where the efforts of going into the ghetto pay dividends, especially if you're working with the young people. Because if you give them the education, if you give them the opportunity to get the type of education that will allow them to become an engineer or a physicist or a doctor, then you are creating a middle class that eventually, hopefully, will not be a black middle class, it'll be an American middle class. Eventually, hopefully, prejudice will become so stupid by the very face of it that those who are racist will not exhibit their racism for fear of being ridiculed.
But how are we going to give them educational opportunities in order to when our educational system and all the systems in America are racist only?
Well, you change the system.
How?
Well, as I said before, we are 180 million strong and we elect the school board.
Yeah.
But the material of
Now wait. In a school district that elects 5 school board members, you need to tell me that in a school district of 110,000 people, you can't find 5 who have the guts to stand up.
I'm talking about the material
in
the school as books.
Regulates what you have in your school system.
The local community has very little to say about it.
That's
true in Texas.
Yes, and there are some states that are finding that they're getting very hard up tax-wise because they're getting cut off from all federal aid because of it. And they're going to find out they're going to get cut off a lot more. Alabama's already facing it. Huntsville, Alabama is on the verge of closing their schools. Huntsville, Alabama is a pretty important military installation. We have to know a little bit about that because Boeing is so involved with missiles and stuff. But because in the state of Alabama, segregation is a state law, even though it is against the national law, it is de facto. The federal government is withholding all impacted area funds from Huntsville, Alabama, which means they're going to close their schools. They won't have enough money to pay their teachers.
Well, you can have a segregated school even if you send black and white children to the same building. You're not going to accomplish anything like that.
Oh, yes, but now you're talking about a totally different type of segregation. We have segregation in this room.
Yeah,
there are some of you who wouldn't on a bet associate with me outside that door. And that is a type of segregation. But you also...
All the materials that you're using are oriented as a white community. All the textbooks, they've colored in the white faces and made them Negro. So what? It's still the same mother, father goes off to work and get a boy and a girl and a reading and the faithful readers. They haven't changed them at all.
This may be true in Texas.
These are true in the great city textbooks, which have come out of the city of Detroit, which are Ford Foundation money. They're supposed to be so great.
Well, I've seen those books, and I would tend to agree with you. The books that they're coming out with in Seattle on black history, which is an American history book, which is the first book, frankly, I have ever read that doesn't ignore the black man in American history, is one of the best books I have ever read. It doesn't glorify the black man, but it does put him in his place in American history. And it doesn't change the color of any faces, it just adds a few names. I beg your pardon?
It's a pretty good set of inner city readers that I saw in New York that used all photographs of kids from the inner city with, in typical, not just, playing about poverty or anything like that, but more typical interiors of apartments where these kids, might be living.
I think what we're getting down to, and we can go right back to what probably Leo was talking about in the other room, is are we going to talk about how many people die of starvation every year for 2 hours, or are we going to spend 2 hours talking about the discovery of a rapid growing and highly productive rice that has just been discovered and tested in the Philippines that might just be the answer to the hunger problem in the Far East? I mean, we can talk about the problem, as you said before. You can talk about the problem, you can talk about the ghetto, and you can keep talking about it all the time and nothing happens. Or can you find not the book that doesn't do anything, but the book that does do something, and go to your local school board and say, all right, Charlie, here it is. And if you don't, you go.
But what the whole premise of the college, you can say you go, but they aren't going to go.
No, they're not going to go, and they probably won't go in the next election. But whether or not they go depends very much on just how hard you work. Not just you, but a lot of people,
I'd like to be more optimistic. It seems like I've been getting older. Yeah. In the 50 years, my death, people were so prejudiced that their own neighbor could be looked at them as, but they, just because he's working in a different nation, maybe have a little different dialect, they would be real mean to each other just because of some little difference they don't even think about now. So it's a growing process.
It may be a growing process, but it is a different process. The man who can get rid of an Irish dialect and become a Boston dialect instead of an Irish dialect is a far different man than a man who can learn the Boston dialect and still has a black skin.
Sir, you speak of not talking about the negative aspect of this problem, but talking about the positive aspect, what can be done to help. Well, I have yet to hear much emphasis placed on the positive aspect on what has been accomplished for the Negroes. I think the greatest advertisement I've seen in the last 12 months is the Negro gentleman in the business suit, and the headline is, "Who says we can't get ahead? I started out as a janitor, and here I am working for Boeing at the computer, guy. And I cut this down, put it on the bulletin board, same old column. And I went back that afternoon, and there was Uncle Tom scrawled on it. Now you tell me this isn't looking at the bad side of things.
Oh, of course it's looking at the bad side. And don't misunderstand. Don't categorize 20 million Negroes as a group of people who think
ethnically alike. 20 million people didn't draw Uncle Tom.
Well, why?
Just like in 180 million white Americans.
Are there any Negroes that don't know what even to call it?
Why, as a matter of fact, we have a Negro president of student body that was elected by a massive sympathy vote immediately after Martin Luther King was assassinated this spring. But that's beside the point. My question is, why is there no emphasis by Negro leaders placed on what has been accomplished?
Oh, I think there has.
I have full support of, I argue till 2:30 with Roger against a white racist here in this building, in this law office about a week and a half ago. And it was like pushing against a brick wall. But nevertheless, the fact remains that there is hardly any mention at all made of what has been accomplished.
Well, perhaps the reason that that there isn't more positive statements from Negro leaders, although I think there have been some very positive statements. Certainly Martin Luther King made some positive statements. There were some positive statements made when the two major civil rights bills were passed by Congress, by major Negro leaders. I think one of the things that the Negro leaders are violently afraid of is what was said up here a few moments ago of beware of this that is given that can be also taken away. And that is the awareness of, all right, we have accomplished this, but this still remains. And this is the effort of the, in my opinion, of the black leadership to keep white America aware of, you know, you can pass the law, but the law is nothing more than words in a book on a shelf unless the law is implemented. The fact still remains that a black man in many courts in this land, far from getting a fair shake or justice, can't come anywhere close because the man sitting on the bench is a white racist. And he is a judge. Fortunately, our system allows for appeal, and eventually, hopefully, the case can be appealed to a court where a white racist is not sitting on the bench. But the negativism, I think, is being pushed by the black simply because time and time and time again, they hear, as we have heard, what do they want? Look at all we're giving them. Boy, oh boy, they'll never be satisfied.
Less integrated than, you know, and that the median income between Negroes and whites has declined and so on. And so what the Negroes see is a lot of tokenism going on, and yet a downward slope for the mass of Negroes, and part of that is race, and part of that is a technological imbalance in our country.
There's a decline in civil rights in the United States.
What?
Is this to say that there is a decline in civil rights for all individuals in the United
there
States?
There is a decline in many of these. You think that because all these bills have been passed, that the Negro situation has been improving? It hasn't.
No, I don't say that.
You look statistically at a number of issues and
in 19.
I wouldn't advocate, or I wouldn't, you know, say that because Congress passes a bill on civil rights, this cleans up the problem. I, you know, would never say this, but I do not think that civil rights have, you know, degenerated. I think that there is a very...
Well, they're talking about, you know, basic economic progress. It's not very impressive when you look at
it. If you stop to consider that in 1954, the Supreme Court said it's the law of the land that segregation in schools is illegal. And yet, in the southern states, 3% of the schools are integrated. 3%. And in the northern schools, your de facto segregation is probably a heck of a lot larger than that, if the truth were known. And yet in 1954, it was the law of the land that segregation is illegal. Open housing was passed by Congress. It was tested in the Supreme Court. What law did the Supreme Court use to justify the fact that open housing is the law of the land? A law that was passed in 1866. 1866. It's been the law of the land since 1866. Now, we haven't had open housing since 1866. We don't have it now. That's all we need, and yet we expect more from them. The president's council that was set up after the riot turned in a tremendous report. It was certainly a bipartisan report. It was headed by Kerner of Illinois and Lindsay of New York. And yet the president of the United States has yet to comment on his own commission's report. Why? Because the commission said it's going to cost about $22 billion to solve the problems in the city. And $22 billion is what it's costing to fight the war in Vietnam. And there isn't $22 billion around. Now, when you have the chief of state of our country setting up a commission to find out what's wrong and then have that commission report back and then have the chief of state remain mute on the report, then I would think that the black man would have a few second thoughts about just exactly what is going on.
And when he calls the law and order, and whose law and whose order, the law and order that protects the white prisoner but knocks the black prisoner to the ground.
There is law.
The black prisoner has every right to go and do and take whatever he wants to, because who protects him from the loan sharks and from all of the kind of crap that goes on in the ghetto where the white man uses the black man?
I don't think anyone has the right to do or to murder or to rape or to rob, but I don't think the loan sharks have any right.
All right, that's what I'm saying. You know, you can't.
The statement of law and order is just that. We have laws of the land, and I think what white America must decide is just exactly, and it almost gets down to a personal decision. Who are citizens of the United States? And when we make that basic decision of who is a citizen, then perhaps we can apply the law and order of the land. Up until now, we haven't made the deal. When we have open housing laws since 1866, that's the law of the land. That's the law. Well, it wasn't the law.
In the last 3 months, you've had curfew imposed on Oregon D.C. twice, and we live, you know, in the city itself. And the curfew is enforced only against black people. So, in other words, if you're white, forget it. You don't have to worry about a curfew. The curfew is supposedly, the curfew on the whole of D.C., that only means black folks.
Well, we've had some rioting. I don't know what happened the last week. I haven't seen a newspaper in Seattle. Thank you. But the previous week, there was a good deal of violence in the Central District. Teenagers and some damage, not too much fire. And of course, it got tremendous play. But the funny thing is that a year ago, out on what they call Elkhai Point in Seattle, a group of teenagers from West Seattle High School, which is basically a white high school, for 2 weeks rioted every single night, turned over cars, burned, broke windows, and it was youthful exuberance. And there was no curfew. Fort Lauderdale is a classic example. And it's this law. Who's the citizen? Where does the law apply? And nothing can change. Nothing can change unless the people make a change. That's the key to the whole thing. Unless we're going to change our whole form of government. If we're going to change our whole form of government so that we have one man without a Congress who can get up and say, this is the way it's going to be, and we will enforce it by martial law, then perhaps that could happen. Or we could change it. We could change it through this system. But you can't change it through an apathetic white population who sits back and says, my goodness, isn't that terrible? And you can't change it by a white population that sits back and watches people stealing color TV sets on live television coverage of a riot and says, my, what is that? This is nonsense. This is stupid. The thing that really struck me was that after watching the funeral of Senator Kennedy all day, my family, including both of my children, watched it. And when the last coverage had stopped, my son went over and turned the dial to a movie where two men were standing there with guns pointing at each other. I thought, boy, if that doesn't epitomize our society, that's it. And the same thing is true in civil rights. You can sit there and you can listen to a Martin Luther King. You can say that he has a dream. And then you can turn on live television in Detroit that shows how they cart out the cases of whiskey and beer and color TV sets and say, boy, aren't they terrible people.
Isn't that near the fact that white America is so violent, hungry, and the fact that white America can accept the kind of press coverage, you know, which is...
I don't know if we're violence hungry. I think we're fantastically egotistical. We are very, very self-satisfied. We're extremely self-centered. We're very, very pleased with ourselves. After all, we have built the greatest land that ever was.
Well, this should not be subjective.
Don't misunderstand me. I think this is the greatest land that ever was. Far and away, I think it's the greatest land that ever was.
It's just that we have this, I listened to a lecture this morning on glaciers, and I think we have this giant crack. It just split it wide open, and we still could be the greatest glacier in the world.
He's in the series, the frontier series, that we build up so strong and big enough, you know, move on to something new. If you don't like it here, move out. They don't like it here, once they leave. And we never did really face our problem. And we are, for the first time, facing it. We're going to be right here. We aren't going to all, if you don't like it here, you go to the moon. You've got to face what's there with you and what you made or who the other guy is.
And this is,
and we've always said we'll move out, or they can move out, or we left them there.
This to me is the initial step, and it's not something that's solved overnight. It's not something where tomorrow we can say, gee, we've made tremendous progress, because we're not going to. But the initial thing is the awareness. The awareness by the person who's sitting out in this suburbia. The awareness of the person who is in Washington, D.C., where a curfew is in effect, who realizes that the curfew is for the black person and calls to the chief of police and says, hey, there are 5 white kids down on the corner, it's after curfew, I want them arrested. It's the awareness of the problem we face. And from the awareness, then comes the action, and much of it will be toe-stubbing. Much of it will be wrong. But if there is an awareness, if there's a massive awareness, there can't be a total awareness, just like you won't get a total effort on the part of the black community for a solution. You'll always have the area in the black community that will want a separate nation, a separate state. As they say, we'll take Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, and you can have the rest. They've got a point. But they'll fight that, just like we will have our ultra-right, our birch society.
I talked to a minister back in Illinois just near the end of the school year, and he's the campus pastor at our Canada, and he's been involved in many community programs allowing Negro children to get cultural advantages that they don't have. And I guess at the day, at that time, he was very, very discouraged. And he's a strong man, a tremendously strong personality, but at the time he was almost at the verge of just breaking down. And he spoke of the dream he had. It is just a particular low point. But he was especially discouraged because he said he had come to the realization that the dream he had wasn't going to reach fulfillment in his generation, or his son's generation, or his son's generation.
This is a great disappointment.
And that it's a situation where Negroes are going to have to use white educational structures and white money to gain black ideas and things. And it's not going to happen in his time. He was crushed by that realization. And I hope not defeated.
I hope
but
not.
There's that danger.
There was an interesting program on our educational station, Seattle Channel 9. And this happened, and I, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it was Omaha, or Lincoln, Nebraska. This was a Lutheran church. Was that the name of it? Where he tried to get the inter... He tried to get the...
Because the national NBC or ABC refuses to show it.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
I wonder, you know, if this had been in Jackson, Mississippi, everyone would have gone... This wasn't in Jackson, Mississippi.
It's the opposite of the news coverage. It's from my Jackson, Mississippi, so none of that happened. It was wrong news coverage. It's the opposite.
I know that in Jackson, Mississippi, they have yet to show a Harry Belafonte special.
Well, when the riots were there, they weren't shown on their own local TV, so they said it didn't happen. It was exaggerated news media outside of their city, but the other city, what was it going on?
I covered, when I was doing news, I covered the initial integration efforts in Little Rock, Arkansas. And one newspaper, the Little Rock Gazette, attempted to do an objective job of reporting. Not pro-integration, just objective. They received a Pulitzer Prize for it. They also went bankrupt because they lost every inch of advertising space. I don't know if it's in operation again or not, but I know that when I left, they were on the rocks. They had the Pulitzer Prize and that's it.
Well, I was going to say, can't you make your points to people without going to drastic measures? Like I worked for a newspaper myself, and we were going on strike. Of course, we have to say that we're going on strike. I mean, we have to present a drastic measure. But when it came down to the facts, we decided it was better to continue negotiations, although we had been negotiating for about 9 months already. But we decided that we'd go back and tell them that we'd rather settle our difference at the negotiation table than be settling our difference out in the street.
I think that depends on what your difference is. I would think that there are several unions that have reached a point where this was totally impossible.
Well, we were going to try. We decided that would be, we'd give it a try. We weren't going to be the first to say we're going out before we could say it wouldn't work.